Hello and welcome back to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I'm an oral maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado, and I really appreciate you tuning into the episode today. Thanks to all those who have emailed and texted me ideas about topics for the podcast or guests they want to hear from. If you would like to be a guest on the show or know someone you'd like to hear from, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Also, please visit our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, if you'd like to search the podcast in an easier way by topic. We'd like to hear from everyone and really appreciate you guys listening. Keep in mind that everything we're discussing here is based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement everything you're learning here with approved research studies. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Aaron Liddell. He's an oralomaxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast again.
Yeah, always a pleasure to be with you and spend time with you and your listeners. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. We had this idea of trying to kind of talk about cases, closed claim cases, in the effort or the hopes to kind of learn from, you know, different mistakes or, you know, issues people have had. I know these are always highly attended kind of talks and courses that are given at Amos and other type venues. And I think we're all just fascinated anytime we hear a story, you know, whether it be a colleague or friend of a friend or somebody has an issue. For some reason, as surgeons, we all pay very close attention. We want to know the details. We want to know what happened, because that's how a lot of our learning happens, you know, is through kind of anecdotal stories and stuff like that, which is very helpful. And for some reason, the story type format kind of sears, you know, these into our mind, especially when it's a real story that happened to somebody. And I think it can benefit all of us to kind of hear some of the things going on. So we'll keep anonymity with these cases, even though a couple of them that we're going to discuss are closed claims, which means they're released and anyone in the public can have access to some of the stuff. But these first two, I am basically just kind of borrowing from an Amos type online lecture that was given. And then I have one of my own that we can discuss, and we'll see how far we get today. But we'd kind of like to make this a series and discuss this in the future. I recently did one with Joe Funderburk, where he discussed a couple of his cases where he had some anesthesia-related type allergies. And so that was good to kind of hear his experience in getting through that. Okay, so this first case, basically the case of a 63-year-old female who presented for extraction of 7 periodontally involved mandibular teeth with IV sedation. She had a medical history that was significant for end-stage renal disease, diabetes, and hypertension. Meds included nifedipine, Coreg, citalopram, Protonix, and Seroquel. And then, you know, we're just kind of burning through this real quick, but the basic anesthesia regimen or her experience that she had, she was administered 5 milligrams Valium IV, 100 mics fentanyl. This is just the information we kind of, basic information that we're given or that was released, I guess, so that we can extract from this case. She became apneic after that. Her heart rate dropped to 20. She was administered 100% oxygen and 0.4 milligrams atropine. Then her heart rate improved to 56. Then we don't know the exact timing of this, but shortly after that, she was administered naloxone and the EMS was called. And then apparently the case went downhill quickly, because the next information we have is that she was, the OMS intubated her, chest compressions were begun, and then she was defibrillated twice. And then she was transported, you know, the EMS continued CPR, but then the patient ended up expiring in the emergency room. And then the other kind of after the death, the patient or the coroner's report stated that the patient died from cardiac dysrhythmia secondary to atherosclerotic disease. So kind of this is one of those where, you know, there could very well be some missing information, and it's hard to really get a clear picture of what happened there. But certainly, we know we're dealing at the very first with a patient who's got some pretty significant, you know, medical issues, specifically end-stage renal disease. And there's really no information we have on how severe her diabetes was, or, you know, her blood pressure and what the status was the day of the procedure. But we can only guess that those kind of medical comorbidities added to this patient, her decline under sedation. Do you have anything you kind of noticed in this case that stuck out to you as being interesting with how this patient kind of went downhill?
First and foremost, we all live in fear of, whether you admit it or not, we live in fear of this kind of stuff, right? Not only having issues with patients' outcome. I mean, this is a catastrophic, devastating outcome. But we're always worried about complications that might lead to litigation. And I think it's in the back of all of our minds, whether you're doing the simplest of procedure to the most complex, you know, procedure, we're always thinking, am I setting myself up here and am I setting my patient up? The second thought is, we also, as oral surgeons, like have this sense of we can do everything and we can do it safely. I think some of that comes from our forefathers and foremothers, whatever, the people that came before us that fought for us to have hospital privileges, to be able to do a history and physical examination, to be able to admit somebody to a hospital and to manage that person. And there's this sort of sense that we should be able to do everything safely, that we can do everything safely. And you know, sometimes all of that training that we have really should help in case selection. I've become, and I don't know how you are, but I've become increasingly gun shy the more I practice. Now, some of that may be because my practice is mostly hospital-based, right? I've said to a good friend of mine who's an oral surgeon, many times, I didn't go into oral and maxillofacial surgery to become an anesthesiologist. It's almost sort of like I'm forced to be an anesthesiologist or to administer anesthesia because that's the paradigm that we've used. But I don't want to be an anesthesiologist. I know some guys and some gals out there love it. They're doing breathe downs and a lot of pediatric stuff. And for me, I'm a surgeon. I went to oral surgery residency to become a surgeon. And I use anesthesia to try to deliver safe care for patients and to try to, you know, keep costs down, try to keep things out of the hospital. But, you know, we all did anesthesia training as parts of our residency. And if there's one thing that anesthesia training gives you as a surgeon, it's the ability to be selective in your cases. It's the ability to look at somebody and say, I think this person's too sick for me to safely do in my office. So, and I don't want to cast, it's always easy to cast judgment and throw stones when you are not there. Personally, for me, I have a 63-year-old female that rolls in with end-stage renal disease, that's got diabetes, who knows how well controlled it is, that has hypertension, who knows how well controlled that is. That to me is like ASA 3.9, maybe even ASA 4-ish tendencies. I don't know how she's going to metabolize medications because her kidneys may not excrete particularly well. We know that her heart, because of diabetes, is going to be, you know, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve responses are going to be slightly blunted. So that for me as a patient, where just at a glance, I'm probably first and foremost going to get a consult out to her primary care doctor and get a sense for, you know, how well managed is she? And then secondly, probably if we're talking, I'm probably going to say, I don't think you're somebody that I can safely sedate in my office. Like, I think that we should either look at doing local anesthesia, or if you have severe anxiety issues to the point where you don't feel comfortable with us moving with local anesthesia, I may need to do you in the hospital with general anesthesia, having an anesthesiologist on board and somebody to manage you. And I know that so many of the people that are probably listening to this are looking and saying, ah, that seems like overkill. But again, I just start looking at some of these things and think, I don't think I can safely deliver this care. The problem that we run into as oral surgeons is people, they paint you into a corner sometimes where it's kind of like, you kind of feel a little uneasy about doing stuff, but they don't want to go to the hospital. And by the way, their insurance doesn't cover stuff that's going to be done in the hospital, and they're going to have this big out-of-pocket cost, and they're too nervous to do local anesthesia. And so pretty soon they have you agreeing to do like what should be a moderate sedation. And the next thing you know, you're doing chest compressions on somebody who's bradycardic and having major issues. So, I mean, to me at a glance, I get a little leery when big organs like the kidneys or the livers or the heart is not working. I start second guessing my ability to safely deliver care in an office, like immediately, unless I think, okay, I can maybe do something with local anesthesia and we can kind of go one tooth at a time and let's see how you're tolerating stuff. But that's sort of just preliminary thoughts on patient selection. So when I think about complications, I think one of the most common causes of complications is poor patient selection, where we sort of like get into stuff that we probably shouldn't be getting into, whether that's an anesthesia risk or maybe it's a procedure that we're doing that we shouldn't get into. But the first thought is this is probably, for me personally, not an optimal patient to be trying to sedate in the clinic. And again, like you said, who knows? Her A1C might be great. She might be totally optimized in terms of her hypertension. And maybe she's got some mild kidney stuff that, you know, is not bad, or GFR is great, and, you know, creatinine clearance is okay. And maybe you consult PCP and they say, yeah, she'll be great. I mean, I'd just be a little bit cautious, but I think she'll tolerate it well in your office. Then, you know, you've done some due diligence, but does that necessarily change the outcome? You're probably still looking at giving some medicine. I guess they used Valium. I don't use Valium personally, but I know there's plenty of guys that do. Fentanyl, obviously, I'm getting away from fentanyl too. It's funny. I'm moving away from all the medicines that put people to sleep. You're like, well, that one's dangerous, you know? So I don't know, but at a glance, those are sort of the things that stand out as I think maybe suboptimal patient selection. And then I don't know how quickly in sequence the medications that were listed were administered. You know, for me, with somebody that I'm a little bit nervous about, certainly as you get over the age of about 55 or 60, I start really slow and really low. You know, I'm going to start out with like minimal doses of medicines and I'm going to observe. So like for me personally, I'm using more midazolam than Valium, but I might in a patient like this start out with like a milligram of midazolam and that's it. And I'm going to kind of chat with them and I'm going to kind of observe them for a little bit and see where they are at a minute and two and five. I'm in zero rush. I know I have some friends that load a syringe with three different medications and it's sort of like everybody gets slammed and off they go. And that's, for me, not ever really been my MO. I just kind of give a little bit of midazolam and we chat a little bit and I observe. I mean, gosh, sometimes a milligram of midazolam in a 65-year-old, they've got a virile sign and they're out. And you're like, gosh, move forward with my procedure. And then, you know, you've observed them. And then I might start with like 25 mics of fentanyl. Let me see how they do with that. I'm going to observe you again for a few minutes. And then maybe I'm going to add on a little bit of ketamine, but it's slow and sequential and not done. Because again, as you get older, as you know, gosh, they just don't tend to respond the same way that young, healthy people do. And then you compound that with kidneys that probably aren't functioning well, secondary to diabetes, I would presume. And then you've got a heart that it's probably got atherosclerotic coronary vascular disease, and it already has a tendency towards problems. And the next thing you know, you're bradycardic and not delivering to the coronaries. She probably had a cardiac event, and that was that.
Yeah, you're picking up on the same stuff that I did. Exactly. That was my first thought. My first two thoughts were, one, just the health issues and, you know, would I sedate somebody with end-stage renal disease and diabetes and hypertension, and probably not, you know, try to avoid that in the private office outpatient setting. And then two, I mean, we always look at the anesthetic regimen and this, I mean, when you just look at that, just 5 milligrams Valium and 100 mics fentanyl, I mean, it seems pretty weak, right? It's like, well, could somebody have any issues with that? I mean, like you're saying, because you're suggesting, which is what I'm thinking, like that had to have been administered pretty quickly. If all 100 mics were given, you know, in one shot or both together, or even within just a minute or two of each other, like you're saying, if it's a older person that doesn't have much reserve and, you know, can't handle that, there could be some pretty quick side effects that the patient can experience, such as respiratory depression. And, you know, sometimes with opiates, you can get some chest wall rigidity if it's administered real quickly. But who knows, you know, how accurate, because some of the sequence of things seems kind of funky. Like maybe we're missing some information. Who knows what else could have been given, what was happening there. And so I think those are, for me, is the two take homes, is just be very judicious with who we're sedating, working them up properly, being okay with saying, hey, this doesn't seem like a good case for you. I'm only trying to do what's best for you. That means today referring you to someone, or not doing this, or taking you to the hospital another day. You know, we need to be okay doing that and put ourselves in a good situation so that we're not facing tons of pressure to make that decision, I feel like.
Yeah, I feel like the further you get into practice, the easier it is for me to look at a patient and say, you know, if they're trying to paint me into the corner, I don't have any issues these days. Just saying, I don't think you and I are seeing eye to eye. Like, my goal for you today is for you to walk out of my office, or at least leave the office in a wheelchair, but totally alert, responsive, and then live tomorrow. And there's a good chance that doesn't happen if something goes awry. And I oftentimes use the sort of the adage that in our offices, you're really on an island. I mean, we're out there sort of alone. We've got a crash cart. We have some assistants that are trained in ACLS and PALS and whatever, but it's not like pushing the code blue button at a hospital where all of a sudden you've got critical care doctors and anesthesiologists, and you've got, I mean, the boat is loaded for immediate and rapid intervention. This is kind of like you give it to them, you're looking over there at your machine, vitals are looking a little sketchy, you're readjusting the blood pressure cuff. I don't think that's accurate. Let's double check that. SpO2 is dropping down. Does she have fingernail polish on? Maybe that's what's up. Is the oxygen turned? I mean, you're sort of slowly moving through all these algorithms. And then before you know it, you know, you're sort of like, oh, geez, all right, let's give some naloxone. I mean, I guess the presumption is that it was the opioid that was causing the issues. I think it sounds to me like the oral surgeon acted appropriately in terms of like, look, let's try to reverse the cause. Let's try to get the O2 up. I don't know if they tried to bag the patient or why the decision to intubate was made, but it sounds like they did the right stuff, but I think maybe got into a mess because of poor patient selection in the first place. And, you know, let's be honest, I'll bet you that there are a lot of patients in this exact same demographic, so to say, that have been sedated in oral surgeon offices over many years, and you just dodge bullets. You know, you just dodge bullets, and then eventually, you know, one goes south like this. That again, I mean, I think more than any time in the history of our profession, we're under scrutiny right now. We're being scrutinized heavily by a lot of people that don't want us providing single provider anesthesia. And so if there was ever a time to really dot I's, cross T's, and make sure that you were being as prudent as possible, it's right now. I think we're seeing all of these different states really lobbying to take that ability for us to do this away. And, you know, part of our being able to do this is good patient selection to begin with.
Totally agree. Okay. Those are some kind of good points, I think, to think about. The second case is unfortunately also not a ton of good background on this patient, but I think some similar type stuff and different type stuff. It's a 46-year-old male who had a history of hypertension, so younger, and apparently just hypertension. He was just taking amlodipine 10 milligrams Q daily. They don't say the patient's weight, but the patient was obese. That's all we know. IV access was poor, so it was very difficult apparently to get an IV. You know, an IV was established and the patient was administered also Valium, interestingly enough. He was administered pre-op Valium for anxiety in preparation for doing the sedation, getting the IV. He was there at the office for 3 severely periodontally involved wisdom teeth. So it sounds pretty simple to extract these teeth. And then his pre-op regimen of Valium was 10 milligrams PO the night before, and then 10 milligrams the morning of, 1 hour prior to the procedure. Apparently, it was noted that he was sitting on room air at 93% prior to being sedated. At 9:48 a.m., he was given 1.25 milligrams Versed, 50 mics fentanyl. So sounds pretty light to start out, pretty probably common to a lot of people. He was then given 12.5 milligrams of Phenergan, 10 milligrams ketamine. You know, still, I think probably a lot of people were saying, yeah, that sounds pretty fair, not too heavy. And then it says he was given a total of 123 milligrams of propofol by IV infusion pump and 136 milligrams of Articaine, which is just a little more than two carps of Articaine. I guess the pump was started at 9:48 and then it was noted that at 9:18, so approximately 30 minutes later, 58:08:18. Yeah, 30 minutes later at 9:18, he was noted to be sitting at 68%. He became combative and pulled off his pulse ox and EKG pads and also pulled out his IV. So that hurts. Pulling off your pulse ox and EKG pads is like, well, that's okay. We could put those back on. But when you're a really hard stick and you're obese and you pull out your IV, I mean, that sucks, right? It then says oximeter reading did return to 90 and the OMS elected to continue the procedure to completion. So at 30 minutes, it's interesting that the 30 minute mark, he wasn't done with the procedure. So he still kept going, which is interesting as well, because there are just three severely periodontally involved teeth. So he finishes the procedure to completion. It was noted that he needed a tongue suture and nasal airway placed in order to maintain the airway. 10:41, the procedure was completed and the patient became unresponsive. That's all we get at that time. So also interesting, the procedure is completed and he's unresponsive at that point. And then it says EKG was noted to be in a systole. CPR was started, 911 called. It was noted to be a difficult intubation at the hospital by the ER physician. So it was a very difficult airway. And it says an IO was needed to provide meds, so an intraosseous type delivery of medications. And then it said, despite all efforts to revive the patient, he expired at the hospital. So another case where, you know, we only have so much information and there's kind of a lot of black holes as far as our information goes here. But what stands out to you in this case?
I'm sure that I'm looking at this the same way that you probably did. The obese thing for me, like, is almost a deal breaker in my office. Like, we don't know what his BMI is. I'm always looking at patients thinking, okay, in a pinch, how intubatable are you? How crikeable are you? What's your neck like? What are your landmarks like? How easily can I get an IV in your arm if you DC the IV, if you, you know, pull it out, et cetera? I mean, I'm kind of looking at all these things. And now you've got somebody that rolls in. They've got obstructive sleep apnea, I'm sure, secondary to obesity. That's an automatic ASA-3. And I really use that ASA classification system heavily. Truthfully, I feel like in my office, I'm doing ASA ones and twos. As you start getting into the threes, I'm much less excited to be doing things for patients, especially in the context of obesity. So now you got a guy that's obese, that's probably got obstructive sleep apnea, that's probably got a big neck. We've now given them some preoperative Valium. I don't know how you feel about preoperative medications. I'll share with you my own anecdote for that is I don't give anybody anything. I have partners that give people all sorts of stuff. They're given Halcyon and they're given Valium and whatever. And I have a lot of friends that do as well. I don't treat anybody with a preoperative anxiolytic. And I just have a very frank discussion with them. And I say, look, I'm sure there are lots of people around that can and will. And if you want that, I'd be more than happy to have you see one of my partners or whatever. But for me personally, I don't know how you're going to metabolize PO medications. The procedure could go really quickly. You take that medication not too far before my procedure, and that stuff might be hitting when you're in the car ride home. And now I've got your escort trying to manage an overly sedated patient.
Hey guys, real quick, KLS Martin is offering a summer sale special that includes 35% off instruments and a BNR special that includes two free handpieces with the purchase of a console. This is an amazing offer and it's limited to one console promotion per customer and is only valid until July 31st, 2023. So the BNAIR ChiroPro L allows for both implantology and surgical applications with up to 80,000 RPMs, which I love. I use it on the 80,000 RPM setting every time I'm doing thermal extractions and have no issues with power or comfort or control. I just love how they feel in my hand when I'm using them, and I just can't say enough about this system. So please use the promo code capital EOSS, lowercase UMMER, 2023 to take advantage of this offer. Enjoy.
I usually just say, look, if you have a lot of anxiety, we can turn up the nitrous and I'll use that to start an IV. And once the IV's on, you're going to be in good shape. I don't even know how many people in OMS are giving pre-op anxiolytics. I'm not faulting anybody that does. But again, I just look at, for me, I'm not going to give you anything pre-op because I don't have the ability to control how that stuff goes down. I do have the ability to control what I've given you, and I know how you're going to be reacting. So for me, again, I look at the obesity, I look at the pre-op Valium. So you look and you say 1.25 milligrams of Versed. Well, that doesn't seem like a lot, but you've already got 10 milligrams of Valium in the system, right? So, and we know that at some of these higher levels, these benzos can cause breathing issues. It sounds to me like, you know, and the question then becomes, the guy became really agitated. Well, I mean, the number one cause of significant agitation is hypoxemia, right? So you have to wonder, is the guy like not moving air? And because he's not moving air, he's getting super duper agitated. Or is he in stage two anesthesia? It's hard for me to take somebody in stage two that's got a bunch of airway problems and to give him a bunch of meds to dump him into stage three. Because now I think, okay, I'm buying this airway now. Like if there's a complication, this is going to be on me. I would find myself in this case, waking the patient up, aborting the procedure. Again, that's probably crazy town because I have some partners that probably wouldn't do that. They'd probably look at me like I was crazy, but we've all had this exact sedation, by the way, and that is the rodeo anesthetic. Guy's starting to jerk around a little bit. You're starting to get a little bit frustrated. Then you're sort of thinking to yourself, okay, do I give him a bunch of propofol and push him into stage three? Well, now I've got an obese patient with sleep apnea that's not probably going to be breathing. And now I've got to start managing his airway. So am I going to have one of my assistants doing bag valve mask while I'm kind of doing my thing? Or am I going to lighten the patient up, which is probably where I would have fallen in this world? Hey, look, I'm going to lighten the guy up. He's not getting any more medications. And then sort of as he's with a little bit, I have a discussion with him that they probably don't remember, but that is, look, I can't get you safely to the point where you need to be for your procedure. So we can either continue with you being sort of as alert as you are right now, as long as you're not hurting, that's good. Or you can abort it now, call it, and we'll get you over to a hospital where they can safely get you to a plane of anesthesia where I'm not having to worry about your airway. So, you know, I don't look at the 1.25 milligrams of Versed or the 50 mics of fentanyl is a huge issue. The Phenergan, I don't know. I've gotten to where I don't give a lot of other meds. I just don't like to muddy the waters. Phenergan can also be sedative as well, right? Like in the hospital, we're not really giving a lot of Phenergan these days. In fact, I think at Swedish, it might be off the formulary for IV Phenergan. You can still use suppository and PO, but they're really just sort of, for some reason, they've gone back to Compazine, which is bizarre, and Zofran. And then the prop, I mean, you know, I would be curious to see how many mics per kilo per minute that pump was pushing. I mean, if you add 10 milligrams of Valium and Versed plus 50 mics of fentanyl, and then maybe they gave him a 50 milligram bump of propofol and then started having it trickle in at, you know, 50 or 60 mics per kilo per minute. Now you've got a problem, right? Now you've got an apneic patient that's agitated. And then, I mean, talk about worst nightmare, they DC the IV. Now you have no ability to deliver anything. I can envision this patient because I've had this patient. You're like, you're sticking in the arm, you miss on both sides, and you've got their freaking shoe off, and you've got a tourniquet around their ankle, and you're, you know, flipping their dorsalis pedis with your finger, trying to find a vessel. The family's looking at you like you're off in no man's land. Like, why is the dentist got my shoe off, sticking an IV in my foot? Like, look, we've all been there, but you have to start asking yourself, maybe, again, this goes back to case one, maybe this isn't the right patient to be doing this on in the office. And again, patient might get a little upset, like, hey, look, I can't afford the hospital and I got these teeth that are causing problems. That's where I sort of say, look, we can't get IV access on you. I think you're a high risk sedation just based on body habitus. sleep apnea, et cetera. I just don't feel comfortable doing this in the office. I think, you know, probably be safe as doing the hospital. Or look, nobody ever died from a little local anesthesia. Like, let's give you a carp. Well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe somebody has, but, you know, let's block you up and start on an upper. You know, those are usually not too exciting. Let's see how you do. And if you do okay with that, we'll move to the next one and we can kind of go one tooth at a time. But again, I guess that for me, the first thing that jumps out is the obesity thing. And it goes right back to what we all learned in our anesthesia rotation, which was patient selection. This is probably not the right person to be doing in the office. What are your thoughts?
You know, one is clearly we're seeing a picture painted of a very difficult airway here. And so we know that obesity is one part of that, but like, I would love to see the other information, right? Like, well, what was his throat chin length? What, you know, a neck circumference? What was his malam potty? And I just wonder, did the provider get that info or no? Did they do a proper airway exam? Because, I mean, clearly more than one provider in this situation had trouble getting this guy's airway. So it reminds me just of the importance of really doing a thorough airway exam beforehand. And I think we should all have our own cutoffs or limits where we're saying, you know, hey, if X, Y, and Z are present over these values, like for me, it's just a no-go with sedation. You know, we need to have some hard stops where, and even if that means like trying to put point values to each aspect of the airway and saying, oh, if I get over a certain point, I don't know how you do it. But I think oftentimes we can get a little too complacent with just kind of eyeballing people, you know, and thinking, ah, yeah, we got this, and not really doing a thorough airway exam and really checking things and, you know, looking down their throat and thinking, wow, this would be very challenging if, you know, I had to salvage an airway. So that's one that sticks out to me.
The idea is we're using the exam to arrive at a diagnosis, right? So often we get really complacent. Okay, he's a malam potty 4, neck circumference 18 centimeters, thyromental distance 1.5 finger breadths, tongue is massive, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, you've checked all the boxes, but you as the provider should be saying, okay, now that I'm looking at this whole picture, this is a bad idea. So it's sort of like a lot of times you just check the boxes so that, you know, on your anesthesia record, well, I took a BMI, I looked at his malam potty score, I looked at his thyromental distance, I looked at his tongue size, I looked at his neck circumference, blah, blah, blah. I did all those things. Well, that doesn't like add any safety to the patient. You're supposed to be adding those things up and saying, the sum total now of all of these things is probably pushing me over that threshold that you just alluded to where I say, I think this is a bad idea.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing was, you know, given 120 milligrams bupropion infusion, I don't really use a prop pump in my private practice just because most of the cases I do are short and there's no need for it. But I do use that when I'm helping out at Denver Health and covering their clinic. And I love the prop pump from the standpoint of, you know, being able to just to put a couple buttons and set the thing and you just kind of sit back and relax, so to speak, or it's like kind of that robotic type thing. And it's great that it delivers that stream and it's kind of a more smooth ride with the prop. But at Denver Health, you know, the attending's the one who does the pump and pushes the prop and watches it. And then the resident is the one doing the case and we're kind of working together. And I'm telling the resident, hey, you know, it looks like, and I'm watching the monitor, this is going on, that's going on. I think when you're the sole provider and you have a prop pump, you just need to be careful. You don't have a false sense of security. Cause I think it's easy just to set the prop pump and you kind of think that it's all taken care of and you're just focused right on the teeth and doing that. And you can kind of get in this false sense of security where you forget to really keep checking the vitals and looking at everything and assessing, or is this really the right settings that I've put on the prop pump, you know, and how is the patient tolerating this? And if they're obese, it's not quite as smooth because now their, you know, fat is releasing some of the effects of this medication. So that kind of raises some red flags for me. I wonder if some of that was going on because that prop pump was there. I don't know. Do you use a pump in your practice?
You know, I don't. And it's probably the same reason that you don't. Most of the things that I do in office are really pretty quick. And then I'm getting to where we work with, at the hospital, I work with US Anesthesia Partners Group. And there are a few providers in their group that will actually come into the office and do anesthesia for you, a couple anesthesiologists and a CRNA. And I'm kind of getting to where, like, if I have like a really long all on four case where I'm taking out upper lower teeth, I mean, I just don't want to think about anesthesia. Like, I just want to be the surgeon. Like, there's no chance on God's green earth that I would do a double jaw and administer the anesthesia at the same time. Couldn't do it, right? And for some reason, it's like you're sitting down to do like a 2-hour procedure. You know, let's say you got to take out 28 teeth and level the alveoli. And I use stackable guides for all on four when I do those. So I got to situate those. I mean, I'm just so involved in the surgery there. And mind you, think about people that are losing 20 plus teeth in one setting. I mean, they're not 22-year-old healthy kids for the most part. They're probably in their 50s and 60s, and they've got some stuff going on. And now we're going to do like a 3-hour IV sedation on this patient. I've sort of gotten to where, like, I just like load the boat and bring in people that can focus on that. And so we look at that and you say, well, there's revenue loss because I, you know, maybe I could have billed for 2 hours of anesthesia. I don't care about that stuff. I just sort of look at it and say, I don't have to think about that at all. And actually, when I'm done, like, let's say that things were going in a bad direction, you've got somebody staring at your vitals machine and they're managing stuff and they're there to help you drop an airway. Let's say this guy, maybe you had an anesthesiologist in there. Maybe things are handled a little bit differently, or maybe the intubation goes a little bit faster. I don't know. So I don't use a pump because I've found that for cases that are going to be real long like that, I don't even want to be doing the anesthesia, truthfully. And I think I'm probably an outlier in our specialty, but I'm a surgeon. I'm not an anesthesiologist. I think I can safely deliver anesthesia and I can safely decide who I should be delivering anesthesia to. At the end of the day, you know, I think there are limitations in my hands for operator administered anesthesia in terms of people where I say, let's be totally honest, in a 16-year-old that you're taking thirds out on and you give them 2.5 milligrams of Versed and 25 mics fentanyl and 25 milligrams of ketamine, how often are you looking at the machine during the, you know, 17 minutes that it takes to pop out the wisdom teeth? You know, it gets a set of vitals, you give your anesthesia, 5-minute cycle goes, everything looks good. 5-minute cycle goes, you're done with the upper teeth. You know what I mean? And sort of like, you're really not having to do a ton. And most of the misadventure is at the beginning. And that's if you over sedate, you know what I mean? And so it's sort of like, okay, you know, you over sedate, they get a little liquid on the cords, they go into a little laryngospasm, they start to buck a little bit, you break the spasm with positive pressure ventilation, patient starts coughing a little bit and you fight the cough while you're numbing them up. And then you sort of get them into that plane and off you go. But when you're doing these longer cases, it's just sort of like, it just becomes really hard for me in a 2.5 or 3-hour procedure to be the anesthesiologist and to be the surgeon. Not to say you can't, because there's lots of people that can, but I just kind of look at for me personally and say, that's not something I really enjoy doing anymore. So I'd rather, you know, have a colleague that comes in and helps out. You guys use any mid-levels or any anesthesiologists for that kind of stuff? Are you guys kind of doing all your own stuff? Or
not really. I mean, pretty much 99% of the time I'm doing my own stuff. But occasionally we will have a mobile anesthesia group, you know, dental anesthesiologists come. And if we have, like, let's say several really young ped cases, and they kind of will help us line those cases up in a day and mask them down, you know, for kids that are kind of too combative to do an IV on without holding them down, stuff like that. So occasionally, but most of it I do myself. The other thing that stood out to me in this case was, so it says 3 severely periodontally involved wisdom teeth from start to finish, at least from start of push med to, which was 9:48, to the procedure was completed 10:41. So that is approximately 53 minutes. For me, is like, whoa, what was going on there? Like, how could it take that long to take out 3 periodontally involved wisdom teeth? And so for me, like, I like to have some time limits on myself that I've kind of set mentally ahead of time. And for me, it's like, it kind of started in residency. I had a program director who said to us, you know, if you're taking longer than 10 minutes on one tooth, you need to stop at that 10-minute mark, call over to one of the attendings and have somebody else come in and look at what you're doing and possibly figure out how to help you because there's something wrong, right? And so I think we should have some type of time limit in our head where we're saying, if I don't have, you know, these three perio teeth out within the next, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, there should be some way for us to kind of prepare for that and say, here's my time cutoff. If I'm in this, you know, at 30, 40 minutes, I need to stop, wake the patient up. We need a new game plan because clearly what's going on is not working. And I think if you haven't made that mental decision ahead of time, it's hard and you almost get in like a time warp, right? You don't realize how much time is going by. You're fighting the patient. He's moving around. He's ripping stuff off. You know, you're giving more meds and you're sweating. And, you know, we've all been there where we look up and all of a sudden like 30 minutes just went by in the snap of a finger. I don't know. Do you have any type of, you know, mental like tick marks that you're kind of checking off when you're doing a procedure? And do you have a way of stopping yourself if like things are going too crazy?
I'm like super duper lucky. I'm in the office with one of my partners basically all the time. Every once in a while, I'm in one of our offices alone. But for the most part, there's always two guys in the office where I practice. So in fact, shout out to Mike Hale, my partner the other day, who zipped in and slipped a tooth out for me. You know, it's funny, like get out 12, 15 years and you think that nothing can get you. And every now and again, you're just like flailing. And it's sort of like, I don't know what is going on here, but I'm having some major issues. And so, and I've done the same for them. Like they'll say, hey man, can you come in here and take a quick peek at this? You know what I mean? And you poke your head in and just another set of eyes. And like if most of the time you can just like zip in, it's a fresh set of eyes and a fresh approach and boom, you pop it out real fast and off you go. So for me, I'm kind of lucky because like, again, I think that I don't know if 10 minutes is a hard and perfect stop point, but I think we all know when we've sort of been spending too much time on a site. In fact, all your listeners are going to think Liddell's a total sellout because I wake all my patients up and I don't do any anesthesia. But it's like we have this huge influx of like, I don't know, 12-year-old wisdom teeth. And it's like they come in for the consult, the lower eights are obstructing the eruption of the lower sevens. And then, oh, by the way, while you're in there, can you quickly snag all of the wisdom teeth? And you're looking at the pano and the uppers are like in the orbit. And then you're like, do the exam and the patient doesn't really have like a tuberosity because the coronoid like impedes it. And you're, so I've gotten to where, like, I have no problems telling patients either. Like, hey, look, your upper teeth are like super high. And I think that I'm just going to take out the lowers right now because they're causing problems, the eruption of the second molars. And we're going to circle back and do these uppers. The more common situation for me is I do so much orthodontic surgery. I get a lot of patients with hypoplastic maxillas. They haven't really grown. Their thirds are way impacted. And I just say, look, I'm going to take these out when I do your jaw surgery in 3 or 4 years. But we will get the lowers, you know, out so we can get the lower sevens erupted and optimally functioning. But again, that goes back to like, don't be scared to just, you've been in these same shoes. You look at a pano and you think, oh, this is going to not be fun. Well, look, nobody's making you do that stuff that's not going to be fun. So like, make your life easy. Don't try to be a hero. I guarantee you those highly impacted upper ones are the ones you're going to stick into the sinus or be chasing up into the infratemporal fossa. Like, why are you doing that to yourself? Just say, look, we're going to put this off for another day. I will sometimes say, hey, while they're under, I'm going to take a quick peek on the upper. If I can find the tooth real quickly, we're going to snake it. If we can't find it, I'm not going to spend a ton of time looking around for it. It's a stitch in, no harm, no foul. And it's amazing that families are like, you know, I mean, you sit back and you're like, you're going to what? You're going to make an incision and then not do anything. But a lot of times the family is sort of like, if you explain it as it's a really actually pretty simple little incision, we'll go up there. And if I can see it quickly, I'll grab it. If not, I don't want to spend a lot of time digging around. Most people are pretty appreciative of that. And more often than not, you can find the tooth really quickly and off you go. The ones that you think are going to be a mess sometimes are pretty easy. And the ones that you don't think are going to be a problem can be a nightmare. But again, don't commit to doing stuff that you don't need to do. Like, fine, put the uppers off for 5 years. The kid's 13 and you see them when they're 18 and they're way easier to get at that point. And, you know, frankly, maybe you could even do it with local anesthesia. You know what I mean? So I, again, have just, same thing goes with like my nemesis, my own personal nemesis, is the lingually impacted mandibular supernumerary bicuspid, which I just dread seeing on my schedule. I can't stand them. And I on those have also gotten to where, I mean, I use the cone beam CT and I'm like looking at it and I'm like, it should be right here. There is no reason that like, I'm measuring with like my tool and I'm exactly where it says I should be. And then you move a centimeter forward, you know, directly lingual to like the canine and there it is. And you're like, why on my CT scan does this look like it's directly lingual to the second molar? And it's like, you know, not even in the same zip code. Anyway, on those two, I've gotten to where, like, if I'm in there and it's you know, it's a big problem when you shift to the opposite side of the patient. So you can see, I mean, it's like, you know, I just tell families, look, we got in there and I felt like the risk was higher than not. We're going to let this grow a little bit. We'll circle back. So again, I don't want everybody thinking that I abort every anesthetic and I abort every procedure, but just like you said, realize when it's been 35 minutes and you're still working on the same tooth, like it's probably an issue and maybe it's best to close it up and call in a colleague, do whatever, but you know, you don't want to turn what should have been a, like you said, 10 minute tooth extraction into, you know, a 2 hour ordeal, a 2 hour anesthetic. And now your anesthesia is starting to wear off and you're depending on that sedation, which means you're going to have to get them deeper, which means you're going to buy the airway kind of thing.
Totally agree. I love that. I'm glad you have Dr. Hale, somebody there to kind of bounce things off of or take a second look. I think if you don't have that, I mean, because I sometimes am in the office with another surgeon, sometimes not. I personally like to surround myself with a very strong-minded, you know, passionate assistants who don't have a problem saying, Dr. Stuckey, this seems like this case is going long, or, you know, they can speak their mind and it kind of gives me that second voice in my head to be like, yeah, that's true. I haven't been going at this for a while and the patient is acting crazy. And Dr. Stuckey, what do you think? Should we wake them up? That seems like a good idea. Like you need people around you who are going to be able to kind of sometimes pull you out of that surgeon mindset of like, I, you know, no man left behind. I must get this tooth at all costs. And sometimes we can get sucked into that vortex. Yeah, I do the same thing though, honestly, with those high impacted thirds, maxillary thirds. My spiel is usually, you know, if it's kind of on the border and I think I could get it, it's like, you know, I'm going to attempt to get that tooth, but there's a chance that when I get in there, it's too kind of high to get it without bothering your sinus or whatever, you know, getting into more than we bargained for. If that happens, you know, I think it's probably best to stop. We'll suture that up and then just revisit it in a year or two. And I mean, I can't even remember the last time a patient or a parent said, oh no, if you don't get it, I don't want you trying. And so I don't think, and I've never heard of anyone getting sued for not taking out a tooth, right? Like for getting in there and being like, well, this is a little too much more than we bargained for. Let's stop and hold off. I think if anything, it's getting sued for trying to take out a tooth that probably shouldn't have been taken out or you're taking too long, you know, stuff like that. So we shouldn't be afraid, like you're saying, to kind of stop and say, hey, this might not be the best thing to do today at this moment. Okay, well, that's good. You know, I had a couple other cases, but I think we can leave that for next time. We'll build some suspense with our listeners. But thank you for reviewing those with me and kind of giving your opinion and sharing some of your experience. That's invaluable. And I learned a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, as always, thanks so much for having me. And again, I mean, to the listener base, we never want to shy away from anything. And that should include saying no when we should say no. You know, I mean, in my practice, you find it flattering when you do the most challenging cases and people seek you out to do revision work and this and that. You want to tackle these cases that in your mind, you're thinking, yeah, I mean, nobody else wants to do this and I can do this. But I think when it comes to anesthesia specifically and to patients that start to make you second guess, don't be afraid to not go after those cases. Cause like you said, you never got sued for the patient you didn't put to sleep. And not even that, we're talking about two lives lost here that, I mean, I'm sure the surgeons, I've never met a surgeon that sought out to hurt somebody, right? Like neither of these operators thought, man, I'd really love it if this guy coded in my chair today. I mean, I'm sure they went in there and their lives have been changed forever. You know, and it's sort of like just be selective in what you do, because you don't get a problem if you don't start, you know what I mean? So just don't be afraid to shy away. You're not less of an operator, less of a surgeon. If anything, I think you're probably better off for it. So thanks again for having me. And once again, I've rambled endlessly for a solid hour.
No, I love it. You know, one last piggyback, sorry, I'm going to ramble just for 1 second, is that when I was first starting my career, I had that feeling, like you're saying, of like, almost like the patient would look down on me if I aborted, or if I said, you know, no, let's get a med consult or whatever. I thought it was like, I felt less of a surgeon. But then the more I kept doing that and kind of had the guts to do it, the more I realized that the patients loved me for it. You know, like they were like so appreciative. Like it was like the reverse. It was like they respected me more when I was like stuck to my guns and said, you know what? I really don't care how much money you're paying me. I'm here to do what's best for you. And even if you're going to be angry about it, I'm still going to, you know, get that med consult or put you off or not take that tooth out, because I'm the one with all the experience and I can see so much further down the road than you can as a patient who's like, you know, patient list is one yourself. And I have a patient list of, you know, like 20,000. So we shouldn't be afraid. And it really, to me, it's just a practice builder. People love it when you're careful and do the right thing. Cool. Thanks, my man. Let's keep in touch and reconnect soon.
All right, man. Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Once again, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, guests you'd like to hear from, or if you yourself would love to be a guest, please email me or text me at 720-441-6059. I'd also just love hearing from people. If you enjoy the podcast or, you know, learn something from it or talk to a friend or connected with someone because of the podcast, that just makes my day. So please shoot that correspondence over to me, and I will see you on the next episode. Thank you.